Unify parents have a lot of questions about their school district's reaction to the allegations against first grade teacher Jonathan Hovey. The 47-year-old from Forsyth is accused of molesting two of his students at Glenn Elementary School. What's most striking is that one of the victims made her allegations in 2005, though Hovey was not charged at that time. He continued to teach until, 12 years later, a second girl alleged that he inappropriately touched her in his class. WGLT's Ryan Denham recently spoke to four attorneys with expertise in school law to better understand Unit 5's response to both the allegations and the lack of communication with parents. He's in studio now to share what he's learned. Before we get into that, let's back up. What do we know? What are the facts as of today?
So what we know is that a 7-year-old girl accused John Hovey of molesting her during the 2004-05 school year. At that time, Norma Police and DCFS investigate the claim. And the girl's interviewed at the Children's Advocacy Center. But ultimately, no charges were filed, and Hovey continued to teach. The Normal police chief has since said that they were just simply not able to develop enough information to make an arrest that would lead to a successful prosecution. So then fast forward to April 14th, 2019. Unit 5 gets an email from the mother of a second girl who said that Hovey molested her during the 2017-2018 school year, so you know, much more recently. The next day, Unit 5 pulls Hovey from the classroom, puts him on leave. Police and DCFS investigate this new allegation. And then during that time, they find out about this older one from 2005. They re-interview that alleged victim and find out that the allegations are very similar. Then on August 2nd, Hovey is arrested. He's still on leave at this time. He's arrested, and the charges become public the next day, August 3rd.
Why wasn't Hovey fired after the 2005 incident?
I mean, so this is the big question, and the answer is, in short, Hovey wasn't fired because no one proved that he did anything wrong. One of the people I spoke to was Margaret Atien, an expert on education law and a professor at University of Illinois' College of Law.
That's kind of the mystery, that we don't have all the facts and we don't know exactly what was found or what wasn't found. So it's not clear if some of the facts were found to be true but inconclusive as to their meaning, or if the facts were just not substantiated.
I also spoke to an attorney up in Aurora who specializes in school law. He's Brian Baer. He says a school district can conduct its own investigation of a teacher that can run in parallel with DCFS and the police. And he says districts are not necessarily bound by what DCFS and the police do.
The district can always take action on their own in terms of that individual's employment. However, the school district has to be able to have their own evidence and prove their case.
And that's not easy. And not every school employee is protected in the same way. So if you think about a tenured teacher, it usually takes about 4 years thereabouts to get tenure within the same district. That person would have different protections than, say, like a janitor who's like 5 days on the job. Here's what Brian Baer, the attorney, says about this whole process.
For tenured teachers, there is a very complicated procedure under the Illinois School Code regarding how you dismiss a tenured teacher, what hearing rights they have before an independent hearing officer after the local district has taken action.
Baer told me that the burden of proof for a teacher dismissal is the preponderance of the evidence standard, meaning something that's more likely to have occurred than not. And that's different. That's a lower bar than the criminal justice system's kind of well-known beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
It is a lower burden of proof, but it is still a significant burden. And a tenured teacher dismissal hearing, for example, can in many respects resemble a full criminal trial with multiple witnesses, with documentary evidence. It just takes place in a conference room rather than a courtroom.
So these protections may sound a little bit foreign to those working for like a private company, an insurance company, theoretically. You've got much more latitude with a private employer in terms of firing someone with or without cause, so long as you're not discriminating against a protected class, for example. Teachers' unions have long argued that these protections are also aimed at protecting good teachers from false accusations or vendettas, that kind of stuff. So it's unclear whether Hovey was actually reprimanded or put under any additional supervision or coaching, anything, as a result of the 2005 case. This week, Unit 5 declined our requests for copies of like complaints, disciplinary records, any of that related to Hovey, citing the ongoing investigation. Also reached out to the Unit 5 Education Association, which is the union that represents teachers. They declined to comment as well, citing the ongoing investigations.
So as a matter of the landscape, how many school districts, when faced with this sort of allegation, do their own investigation, and how many sort of rely on law enforcement and state agencies like DCFS?
It does happen, but I think there's a reluctance, from what I've heard, a reluctance in school districts to, you know, get ahead of the police or to interfere with a police investigation. A school district might also run up against, if they're going to be talking to victims or family of victims. I mean, how many times do you really want to put someone through the interview process for that? Especially if DCFS and the police are already doing it, and you've got someone telling a difficult story three times. There's limitations there.
And we don't know whether Unit 5 habitually does its own investigation as a matter of process, or whether they did one in this case.
I don't know.
Okay. How were the 2005 allegations documented? Do those records exist?
So this would be another area with a lot of uncertainty. I mean, clearly someone was aware of the 2005 allegations after this newer victim stepped forward. Because when they charged Hovey, a prosecutor said that during the course of investigating this newer case, detectives were made aware of the older allegation, and then they went and talked to that victim again. So somebody, they figured that out somehow. Maybe that's an old police report. Maybe that's somebody in the district who happened to know. So on the DCFS side of things, it's interesting. There are basically two endpoints for a DCFS investigation. Something can be unfounded or indicated. Unfounded means that there is just there's no credible evidence that a child was abused or neglected. Indicated is kind of a weird way of saying, yes, there is credible evidence of abuse or neglect. So presumably the 2005 allegation against Hovey was determined to be unfounded. And in looking at state law actually requires that unfounded DCFS reports be purged from an employee's personnel file. And DCFS maintains like a central database of these unfounded reports, but it only goes back 5 years. And so if Hovey was subject to any disciplinary action stemming from the 2005 incident, Unit 5 may not even be legally allowed to disclose that to the public, to the media. That's because of a different state law, the Personnel Records Review Act, which prohibits employers from publicly disclosing disciplinary actions or letters of reprimand, that kind of stuff, that are over 4 years old, which it would certainly be in this case.
Was Unit 5's response to the allegations typical for a school district?
That's unclear from the 2005 case, given how little we know about what happened. But and Unit 5 is oft to say, repeatedly has said, that the current school district administrators were not employed by Unit 5 back in 2005. So like, hey, we don't know what was going on then. But for the 2017 and 2018 victim, the second victim, Unit 5 does appear to be following the standard procedure for responding to an allegation like this. Hovey was placed on leave immediately, like the next day, told not to come back on property. Police and DCFS were promptly notified. Interestingly, too, Unit 5 told Hovey back in mid-July to stop attempting to contact Glenn Elementary School staff, Unit 5 employees, and several other unnamed people involved in the case. We don't know who those people are, but basically this letter that we've obtained shows that Unit 5 is telling Hovey, hey, knock it off. Stop trying to find out what's going on here.
Oh, do we know what he was trying to get from those contacts other than trying to find out what was going on?
No, we don't. We don't know specifically what he's asking them. He was just apparently contacting them, and Unit 5 is saying, knock it off.
Why didn't Unit 5 tell parents what was going on? That's been a source of a lot of pain and anxiety for parents.
Absolutely, yeah. We've heard from several parents publicly and privately about those concerns. Last night, Claire Hedden, whose daughter was in Hovey's class last year, spoke at the Unit 5 school board meeting. She was actually in the classroom back in April, like volunteering, when Hovey was essentially escorted out of the building and put on leave. And she has said that neither the school nor the district has communicated with parents about what happened. They got a letter a few weeks later that said Hovey was on leave for, quote, personal reasons. And here's what Hedden said at last night's school board meeting.
A WGLT news article 4 months later on August 3rd was how I found out that my daughter's teacher was accused of sexually abusing students in 2017, 18, and previously in 2005.
We've also heard from other parents who've said they kind of feel like there's a lack of a forum to discuss what's happened. There's not like a really good place to do this. And Claire Hedden has a lot of questions too.
Why aren't authorities contacting all families that had children through his classroom? Why has there not been a public or parental meeting with Unit 5, Normal Police Department, and the Department of Children and Family Services? If you truly believe Principal Oster's statement that safety of our students is our top priority, what are you doing to ensure that?
So the school law experts that I've talked to say there's a lot of reasons why Unit 5 may not be saying a whole lot. One is that districts obviously don't want to jeopardize an ongoing criminal investigation or get ahead of the police. Sometimes school districts don't have all of the information that a police investigation has uncovered, like in real time. They may not know all the ins and outs yet. They may be reluctant to say something that would hurt an employee's due process rights by publicly disclosing allegations that turn out to be unproven. So here is Margaret Etienne again, that U of I professor from the school or the College of Law.
There is this catch-22 about what schools and principals and school districts can say when the allegations are still pending.
And Unit 5 has acknowledged this conflict. They had a statement out a couple of weeks ago that said we know there's a desire for more information, but we don't want to do anything to compromise the police investigation. Margaret Etienne says there's often a delicate balance between protecting children and then making sure those who are accused can defend themselves.
But when it comes to sex offenses or violent crimes, oftentimes that balancing act does have to weigh more heavily on the side of protecting the children.
Ryan Denham, is anyone trying to improve this process?
Yes. State lawmakers passed a bill this year to overhaul the manner in which these types of sexual assault investigations are conducted. That's actually waiting the governor's signature. Notably, in this case, that bill would allow the State Board of Education to immediately suspend the license of any educator charged with a sex crime or a Class X felony instead of waiting for a conviction, which is the current law. The bill does a bunch of other things, too, to encourage and speed up this whole process, but it's still unclear whether or not it would have made a difference in this case, especially the 2005 part of it. We still don't know enough about the 2005 side of this to really determine that.
What is next for Jonathan Hovey?
So Hovey is now out of jail. He posted a $10,000 bond, and so he's back home, apparently. He's due in court tomorrow for his arraignment, so we're expecting probably a not guilty plea at that point. And while initially on paid administrative leave, he is now on unpaid leave pending the outcome of the case. We heard that from Unit 5 yesterday. Hovey's attorney has declined to comment since the arrest.
Why the change from paid to unpaid leave?
I don't really know, to be frank. I presume it's a matter of the criminal charge being filed. So back when he was being paid on leave, he had not been charged. Okay. Since then, he has been, so maybe that's it.
That's WGLT Digital Content Director Ryan Denham. Thank you very much, Ryan. He's been covering the case for us. This is Sound Ideas.